spirit of poetry. And that's what Ted Kooser has brought to Washington, the spirit of the craft. And we've been talking about some of the ways of entering a poem, some of the ways of ending a poem. And in Chapter 5, you have a wonderful title called Rhyming Ham Cubes and Prose Poems. Impossible to ignore a chapter headed like that. What are the ham cubes?
Well, you know, for years in grocery stores, when you bought ham cubes, they'd come in a little plastic tray with just some cellophane over the top or saran wrap or whatever you call it. And there was a lot of dead grocery store air in there. Now they've begun to do it with a kind of shrink wrap, so the wrapping actually fits the ham cubes. And I'm talking about form, saying that poems that are written in fixed forms ought to be as tightly wrapped in the form or as that, so you don't have any stale air in the poem, that the poem really ought to fit the form perfectly. And that's really the metaphor I'm working with. The book was reviewed by someone, I can't remember who, and who objected to that, saying it was a little coarse image to use with form, but I think it works pretty well myself.
Oh, I didn't know. I have missed the reviews. So do you have several of them for this book?
Oh, it's been reviewed a couple of times. Mm. You know, there was a review in the Wall Street Journal, which may be the one I'm thinking of, but I can't remember right now.
But mostly favorable?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If that's the only thing ever said against you, that your ham cubes are too tight, that's okay with me.
Yeah, that's right.
Ted Kooser.
Well, my position with reviews has always been, I try not to read reviews of my work. It's, you know, the painful ones really are painful, and the good ones are often kind of gassy and fulsome, you know, so you... full of praise that you think, oh, come on.
You but know, if you believe the good ones, you have to believe the bad ones. That's the worst part.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So let's not meddle with them. Let's not even meddle with them.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. Then we have talk about rhyme. Now, rhyme is the biggest bugaboo in, I think, the fledgling poet's career, because I teach seminars with people who have never really written much. And there is the first thing they want to do is rhyme, and you put it in its place. You tell us when it works and when it doesn't work. So there is a sample of unobtrusive rhyme you talk about by Ed Weissmuller,
mm-hmm.
and that poem is The Seahorse. So that would be a very good example to talk about rhyme that's hidden and doesn't offend anyone.
Yes.
That's number 7.
Yes, Seahorse. You might think it would leap the waves in a white fire of foam racing, eyes mad with what might be delight, a runaway, or loosed from a god's team galloping in its vast pasture. But this one was the size of a brooch, thin and red gold and still. The children had sent for it from the Atlantic. It arrived by air in a pouch of seawater containing all it needed to sustain life as it crossed the continent. Following instructions, we made it a small, nourishing ocean in which it anchored itself upright to a strand of seaweed, and staring, jewel-eyed at nothing, slowly faded white and died. Mm. But this is an example of a poem that has a lot of rhyme in it, but they're very neatly woven into the lines, into the middles of the lines, and we feel the effect of the rhyme, you know, at some sort of less-than-conscious level, I think. But it's very carefully put placed there. You know, there are all sorts of rhymes.
Why don't you point out a couple of those words?
Galloping in its vast pasture, or seawater containing all it needed to sustain life. Mm-hmm. Those, you know, half rhymes, slant rhymes, and so on throughout, you know.
Ed Weissmuller is a blind poet. Mm-hmm. A Milton scholar,
mm-hmm.
and he is at the Library of Congress every day doing research.
A marvelous man, yeah.
He is.
He was the first of the Yale Younger Poets, the very first one.
I know. And he is truly a servant to poetry. I was so happy to see that you made his friendship, mm-hmm. because that would mean a lot to him. And he's at every reading. He's at the poetry reading.
Oh, yeah.
This is a masterful poem, so I'm really glad you gave Ed notice. That means a lot. Not only are you teaching us things in this book, but you're really touching a lot of poets' lives. To be included is pretty
important.
Well, thank
you.
You know
that,
yeah. So there's an example of rhyme which is embedded in the poem and is so skillfully. I wonder if that's because he's so practiced and seasoned, it doesn't seem that he manipulated those words.
Oh, no. I think it probably just, you know, it's probably just falling out of his voice in a very natural way. Yeah.
Then in this book, you make a very important point that here's form. It's important. It has its place, and here's why we use it. But, hey, write from your heart,
mm-hmm.
and you will find the form. What do you mean by that?
Well, John Berger, who's a writer whose work I admire a lot, he's a British writer, essayist, novelist, art critic. Somewhere he said that form ought to feel as if it were inevitable. And I think that in order for that to happen, I think it has to come very much out of your natural life in a way. You have to, you know, you can't force your personality into a form that doesn't fit you, you know, and that I believe that poems sort of take their own shape as they develop. If a poem begins, you're writing the first few lines and suddenly it rhymes, well, maybe it's worth pursuing that rhyme a little bit and see if you can do it. You know, you might have to back off on it if it doesn't work. Or if it's clear that it wants to be a very loose, free form, you can pursue that and see how well it works and everything. You know, you have to trust your instincts a little bit on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing is to try to fill a box, like take a sonnet form and write all the rhymes down the right-hand side and then try to write lines that fit them. I mean, it's just dreadful.
I did it once.
Oh, yeah. I think we all have tried.
I came out with sestinas that looked like marble columns. They were just standing there.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Ted Kooser talking to us. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress talking about Poetry Home Repair Manual, which is a book about the love of poetry, but he doesn't come out and say it, but that's what it's about. Now, there is a chapter called Writing About Feelings. Not as easy as it sounds, because you can really mess up if that's all you're going on, writing about feelings. But you do choose some interesting poems there, and one is by you have written yourself. It's called After Years. Interesting, because you state that it is about loss, but you never come out and say.
Mm-hmm.
So let us hear that poem.
Yeah, I might preface it by saying that this is a poem about having seen a woman with whom I was in love at one time, but I hadn't seen her for a long, long time, and I saw her across the street, and I was just struck by this, you know. And so I tried to write the poem in a way that would express my feelings without stating them overtly.
Now, you see why radio is important. You didn't have the in love stuff in that book. That's coming out now.
Yeah.
You just said it was somebody you knew.
Oh, yes.
So let's hear
it. After Years. Today, from a distance, I saw you walking away, and without a sound, the glittering face of a glacier slid into the sea. An ancient oak fell in the Cumberlands, holding only a handful of leaves, and an old woman, scattering corn to her chickens, looked up for an instant. At the other side of the galaxy, a star 35 times the size of our own sun exploded and vanished, leaving a small green spot on the astronomer's retina as he stood in the great open dome of my heart with no one to tell.
Mm. That is your signature. The two things are the moment in time that is like a chip, a crystal chip, that is one thing you work with. And the second thing is no one to tell. That is a haunting refrain in your work,
mm-hmm.
where you... That is almost worse than a death.
Uh-huh.
Because you're about communication.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's the power of that poem. That last line is a dynamite last line. I love that. We're talking about craft, form, and love. And they're all going together in this book. I'm Grace Cavalieri. That's Ted Kooser across the table. And in the book, he cites other poets who exemplify things about poetry. And so we're going to move on to Jane Kenyon.
All right.
Who died too soon and left a nice legacy.
Yes, this is one of Jane Kenyon's lovely poems. She was a marvelous poet. In the nursing home. She is like a horse grazing a hill pasture that someone makes smaller by coming every night to pull the fences in and in. She has stopped running wide loops, stopped even the tight circles. She drops her head to feed, grass is dust, and the creek beds dry. Master, Come with your light halter. Mm. Come and bring her in.
Mm. What a poem.
Oh, isn't that marvelous?
Yeah. Wow. So glad you put that. Then we move to the country of memory. Memory is a place that doesn't go away. The past doesn't go anywhere at all, does it?
That's right. That's right.
And that's a big chapter, a very important chapter. One thing that interested me is I do help people with their books, and I always like to see a uniformity of presentation, and I happen to note that each of your chapters was about 10 pages. Did you know that?
Oh, I suppose I noticed it at some point. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I thought that that was really important because it speaks to you're having a rhythm yourself. And I think a few chapters were a couple of pages more.
Mm-hmm.
This might have been one of them, writing from memory. What is the country of memory?
Well, I have a poem in my book, The Lights and Shadows, in which I talk about it being sort of like a tornado that sweeps everything up in it. And then at the tip of the tornado is the nib of a pen. You have everything in your memory, and then you just sort of let it out a little at a time, you know. But, the country of memory is a very rich place, you know. It's huge. I'm always so struck when people die, and I'm thinking, all of that is gone with them, you know. All of those memories, you know, a tremendous volume of memories is going into the grave with those people, you know.
What a thought. I teach that our lives are a building, and each year is a different floor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a skyscraper, but I mean, if you're 50, you have 50 floors.
Yeah.
And when the end of your life, you stand on the roof and a helicopter sweeps you away and your building crumbles. Because in effect, that is what happens. But until then, we can visit every floor of our building every day and find a poem.
Oh, that's right.
Take that elevator.
Yeah.
Get off on floor 3. What do you see?
Yeah.
And that is such a wonderful way to visit your life because they're here while you're here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I said somewhere in this book that the reason that the human head is so heavy, it's the heaviest, most dense part of the body, is because it is so full of that stuff, you know.
Mm.
Like a bank full of nickels.
Your database.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Kooser is talking about his database, which he put in this book. So we will talk about writing from memory. And one of these poems is Amakai.
Mm-hmm.
Is that I walked past a house where once I lived?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us who he is.
Well, he died, I would think, within the last 10 years.
Not long ago.
Yeah. Yehuda, was an Israeli. Israeli poet, a marvelous poet, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yehuda Amakai.
Yeah. I walked past a house where I lived once. A man and a woman are still together in the whispers there. Many years have passed with the quiet hum of the staircase bulb going on and off again. The keyholes are like little wounds where all the blood seeped out. And inside, people pale as death. I want to stand once again as I did, holding my first love all night long in the doorway. When we left at dawn, the house began to fall apart, and since then the city, and since then the whole world. I want to be filled with longing again, till dark burn marks show on my skin. I want to be written again in the book of life, to be written every single day, till the writing hand hurts.
Mm. I wonder if you know that when you read a poem out loud, how you favor your vowels.
I guess I don't know that.
I've been listening to every one of them and been wanting to say that and forgetting to. That as I listen to them, you really are unconsciously riding them beautifully.
Hmm.
And so it's interesting. We'll be watching that in the next poems too. Then
I'm probably going to be terribly self-conscious about it now, but we'll try it.
Ted Kooser's going to start stuttering, and it's all my fault. Frank Steele, who is he? The poet you
Frank
mentioned.
Frank Steele has taught for many years at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green. He and his wife, Peggy, are both poets. They're retired from the university now. I've known Frank's work for many, many years. He's really never gotten the kind of attention he should have had. He's a terrific poet.
You've been communicating with poets your whole life.
I have, yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting because you hark back to different times in your life where you must communication by postcard, by letter, this has taken up an inordinate amount of your life, more than many.
Well, I don't know. You know, it's been very important to me, and part of it is because, you know, the place where I live, you know, we don't have a lot of poets close around us. We're not down drinking coffee with them in the coffee shop. You know, we're communicating by letter and postcard, as you say, and that's part of it, I think. You know, I have my letters bound every year. I save them, and I've done this for over 30 years now, 33 years now, and I have a, you know, I save copies of the letters I write and copies. If you wrote me a letter, I would, on a postcard, let's say, I would Xerox it onto a full sheet and bind it into this volume. And so I have all this stuff. It's quite a trove of information. And
I wish I had done that. How important. How many volumes do you have?
Well, most of the years are two volumes, you know, probably that together maybe 7 or 8 inches thick. And I have 33 years of those, so I suppose there are probably 50 volumes altogether.
So your papers are at the University of Nebraska?
Actually, they're at home in my corn crib. but they will eventually be somewhere.
With the snakes that you read about.
Yeah.
Ted Kooser is here. He's brought lots of fresh air from the Plains States into Washington, D.C. In talking about the poem we just heard, Parents, by Frank Steele, then you go into a phrase which you call biting off words,
mm-hmm.
not using too much fat in your poem.
Yeah.
And you think Frank Steele is a good example of a man
yes.
who could have put a lot more in.
Yeah, but the poem is right down to the bare essentials, no spare parts, which is one of my mottos. You know, you don't need to, if you're building a lawnmower, you don't put in extra belts and pulleys. And, you know, it's going to mow the grass with what it's got. It doesn't need any more than that, you know. So I believe in, you know, making the poem as economic as possible.
And you do talk about the anecdote, which I am very fond of, because that is one thing beginning poets can do, is just listen to the conversation at the next table. But the anecdote really needs something else going on to make it a poem.
Yeah, it can't be just simply an anecdote. You know, I went downtown this morning and this happened and I came home. It has to, in some way, move beyond that a little bit. Take a glimpse into something in the next world, sort of, you know, that
right.
kind of thing. Or touch against something that has a little electricity to it. And we see so many poems that are just anecdote, simply just spaced out and written down the page, you know. Every time I stand at the kitchen peeling cucumbers, I think of my grandmother who used to stand at the kitchen peeling cucumbers.
Actually, know. I like that.
But you can have it then. Yeah.
It is putting a perspective, maybe a little philosophical. Maybe even the title could do it.
Mm-hmm.
But just raising it off the ground a little bit.
It needs, the Chinese poets say, you need to lift your eyes from the poem. When you're writing.
I love that. Lifting your eyes. And that is, an anecdote is described in that, I think that chapter, Writing from Memory. But we're going to move on because we have a few more of my favorite things I want to address. You have a chapter called Working with Detail. And that is basically just about, specifics
mm-hmm.
and noticing things.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll hear something from each one of those areas.
Okay.
You talk about a poem which is entitled Neighbors.
Oh, yes. Dave Evans' poem. Dave is the poet laureate of South Dakota.
Is he, what press does he have? I think he's the editor for...
No, I don't think so.
Not Dave?
No, Dave is David Allen Evans.
I'm thinking of Dave Smith.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll move on.
Yeah, Dave Smith does that Southern Messenger series for LSU, yeah. Anyway, Dave Evans, this is his poem. This is an older poem of his. It goes back a number of years, but I just love it. Neighbors. They live alone together, she with her wide hind and bird face. He with his hung belly and crew cut. They never talk but keep busy. Today they are washing windows, each window together. She on the inside, he on the outside. He squirts Windex at her face. She squirts Windex at his face. Now they are waving to each other with rags, not smiling.
That was featured in one of your newspaper columns.
Yeah, the first one. Yes, that's right.
tells so much.
Oh, yeah, it's marvelous, yeah.
And the specifics there are so close to the bone. But yeah. We know these people.
We know them, and, you know, one of the things I like about the poem is that it is written in great good humor. You know, it really, it's not being judgmental about these people at all, you know.
Real, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Because many poems can become jeering.
Oh, yeah.
When we think it's high style.
Yeah, not good.
No, goodwill is like what it's about.
Yeah.
And in that line, we will talk about Ted Kooser at the cosmetics department. We don't know what you were doing walking through that department store, but you just happened to notice something.
Yes, you know, my father for many years was a department store manager, and so I've spent a lot of time in department stores over the years. And this was in the walking through the cosmetics department in a store in Lincoln, Nebraska. Cosmetics department. A fragrance heavy as dust, and two young women motionless as mannequins dressed in black. The white moth of timelessness flutters about them, unable to leave the cool light of their faces. One holds the other's head in her hands like a mirror. The other leans into the long fingers, knowing how heavy her beauty is. Eye to eye, breath into breath, they lean as if frozen forever. A white cup with two lithe figures painted in black and the warm wine brimming.
So much going on.
Mm-hmm. I was so struck, very typical of me, the way I start a poem. I was struck by seeing those women holding each other's heads and gazing into each other's faces, you know. It's such a marvelous thing, you know.
And you made it permanent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Noticing things. I guess that would be the first thing on the poet's job resume.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Keep your eyes open. Nothing is unimportant.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And you're proving that for us. Then we get into the sticky stuff of adverbs, adjectives, nouns, and verbs, which are our stock in trade. And the chapter is called Controlling Effects Through Careful Choices. And it seems that adjectives have a bad rap.
Yeah, they do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you are a little nicer about it.
Well, the way it works is you need modifiers. If you put a chicken into a poem and just say a chicken crossed the road, then everybody who's reading the poem has their own idea of what the chicken is like. Could be a white one, could be a red one, could be fat or thin, half the feathers gone or plump. It takes one adjective to do that. Just say plump chicken makes a whole difference in the way the image is. And I'm very interested in communicating the precise image to the reader. I want them to see the chicken that I'm seeing. So you have to use modifiers. And it's just that too many adjectives, I mean, become obvious, you know. That's the problem, yeah.
But then you go on to say, choose the right word.
Well, that's right, yeah. Yeah, it's very important to spend a lot of time making those choices, I think.
Right. Yeah. And a good poem that exemplifies that is Sheep by Robert Francis. Who's Robert Francis?
Robert Francis has been dead for many years. He was a New England poet, lived his last years in Amherst, a really marvelous poet. I think that he was overshadowed by Robert Frost. You know, they had the same initials. They were living at the same time. But Francis's poems are well worth looking at. He's a really marvelous poet, a solitary man. I'm doing what I can to remind people that he's out there. You know?
Well, yeah. I've met a lot of new friends in this book.
Yeah. Anyway, here's Francis's poem, Sheep. From where I stand, the sheep stand still as stones against the stony hill. The stones are gray, and so are they. And both are weather-worn and round, leading the eye back to the ground. Two mingled flocks, the sheep, the rocks, and still no sheep stirs from its place or lifts its Babylonian face. It's just such a touch, isn't
what
it, that word?
Lovely. And you make that point. The word Babylonian
is the important word. Mm-hmm.
It makes all the difference.
It hauls in all sorts of stuff into that scene.
That historical, yeah. it resonates with imagery.
Yeah, and we know right away, anyone who's studied, you know, art knows what a Babylonian sheep's face would look like, you know. I mean, it's right there. It's just his work is so wonderful, you know. He has a poem about watching three men walk down the road in the morning and come back at night. That's all it is, you know. But it's just loaded with feeling, you know.
The right word.
Yeah.
Choosing the right word. And then the next biggie in life is metaphor and simile. And when you go into the classroom, that's the only thing that the fifth grade teacher has taught the kids. So, you know, this is a metaphor and this is a simile, and then you have to take off from that light their fire. What is a metaphor and what is a simile?
Well, you know, a metaphor is a comparison that is more like an identity. You say, that bunch of grapes is a stack of cannonballs, rather than saying, that bunch of grapes is like a stack of cannonballs, which is a simile. I think there's a difference in the psychology. Mm. The first has an emphasis and an authority. The grapes are the cannonballs. The second is much more human in ways. We say so often in a description, we'd say, that bunch of grapes, it's kind of like a pile of cannonballs, you know. It feels more like conversation, I think the simile does. So you have to kind of measure how much authority you want in the poem as to whether or not you use the metaphors. Of course, there are poems that will work in other ways as well, but that's just one of the things to think about, I think.
Well, what I liked is that you took us along on your own struggle with a poem that could have had a metaphor or could have started with a simile, and it's called The Possible Lives.
Yeah.
And that will explain a lot, if you'll read that one.
The Possible Lives. There were once so many I might choose among, a warehouse of coats and shoes and all my size. Walking the streets, I imagined myself in every house, happy with whichever woman might be living there. How might it be to be at home among the odors of 100 different lives, opening the curtains each morning to a different view? Now I know that this life I have is the only one I have ever had or will ever be given, a cord of braided dreams that I follow hand over hand into the distance.
And you say that you had a choice in the beginning.
Yeah, I might have said, there were once so many I might choose among, like a warehouse of coats and shoes and all my size. And, you know, I decided to go with the metaphor, basically for the strength of the metaphor rather than the simile.
So read that line again. That is a metaphor.
The metaphor is, there were once so many I might choose among, a warehouse of coats and shoes and all my size.
Instead of like a warehouse.
Yeah.
That's
a
very good example, I think, in that. Then a metaphor-centered poem is where you take a comparison and just write it. I think Diane Wachowski does that very well. Mm-hmm. I remember the extended metaphor in her poems, for example, My Grandfather's Watch, where she can just reel that thing in stanza after stanza. And you have a couple that are good examples. One is The Student, which starts with a simple comparison, you say. And that's...
you remember where that
numbers,
one is?
It's 16 on a stick'em.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, my stick'ems kind of got lost there.
Student. The green shell of his backpack makes him lean into wave after wave of responsibility, and he swings his stiff arms and cupped hands paddling ahead. He has extended his neck to its full length, and his chin, hard as a beak, breaks the cold surf. He's got his baseball cap on backward, as up he crawls, out of the froth of a hangover, and onto the sand of the future, and lumbers, heavy with hope, into the library.
That's in your book, Delights and Shadows.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And that was just by watching a turtle of a student.
Well, yeah, I'd noticed that in the 60s when people walked with very long straight hair, they kind of swung their head from side to side, and that was sort of the sign of that particular period. And now people, when they're wearing backpacks, sort of paddle with their arms when they're walking along, I noticed, particularly if the backpack is full. And I just couldn't resist this image, you know.
And you did that in another way with your poem, The Camera, which is a simple comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be another good one to read.
Camera.
That's there.
Camera. It's an old box camera, a brownie, the color and shape of a battery out of a car, but smaller, lighter. All the good times, the clumsy picnics on the grass, the new Dodge, the Easter Sundays, each with its own clear instant in the fluid of time. All these have leaked away, leaving this shell, this little battery, without a spark.
Beautiful. that spark does it.
Mm-hmm.
Both the battery and the camera are...
holds it all together.
But it's all gone.
Yeah.
Except mm-hmm. for these relics.
Yeah.
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 And now that we have just gotten to know you, sadly we have to have a closing poem.
Okay.
And that will be one of my very favorites of yours. It's called A Rainy Morning. And it's right here.
A Rainy Morning. A young woman in a wheelchair, wearing a black nylon poncho spattered with rain, is pushing herself through the morning. You have seen how pianists sometimes bend forward to strike the keys, then lift their hands, draw back to rest, then lean again to strike just as the chord fades. Such is the way this woman strikes at the wheels, then lifts her long white fingers, letting them float, then bends again to strike just as the chair slows, as if into a silence. So expertly she plays the chords of this difficult music she has mastered, her wet face beautiful in its concentration, while the wind turns the pages of rain.
The voice of Ted Kooser, Poet Laureate of the United States, Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. The Witter Binner series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C. and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. You can hear this series on www.loc.gov/poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Additional funding was provided by the National Endowment for the Arts because a great nation deserves great art. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.